Three old friends met up at a funeral, and they're busy chatting away at the end. And one of them asked the others, "When you are in your coffin and friends and family are mourning over you, what would you like to hear them say about you?" One of the friends immediately responds, "I'd love to hear them say that I was one of the greatest doctors of my time, a great family man." The second friend pipes in, he says, "I'd like to hear them say that I was a really good husband and that I made a huge difference as a teacher in the lives of many children." The third friend thinks for a little while and then he says, "Actually, do you know what? I'd like to hear them say, 'Look, he's moving.'" You know, we don't like to think that we're going to die, do we? But the reality is that unless the Lord returns first, we will all die. And what words will be spoken about us at our own funerals? We'll all have funerals. What will they say? What marks your life? What would you actually like them to say about you? Would it be that you were tremendously successful in all that you did? Very rich and wealthy and generous? Would it be that you were a real caring family person? Or perhaps the greatest honour that someone could bestow on you at your eulogy would be to say that you were a man or a woman of faith. A man or a woman of faith. You know, there are 14 chapters in the Old Testament devoted to one key character in the Bible, Abraham, the man of faith, as Paul described him. Hebrews 11, that very famous chapter that lists great men and women of faith, pays a huge tribute to that one man and his faith. Abraham, our spiritual father, renowned for his deep faith, and as Isaiah describes him, a friend of God. What a man, what faith. If only we were a bit more like Abraham. It's just that, you know, our faith lets us down sometimes, doesn't it? I don't know about you, but I can be so weak at times. You know, you get frightened, you forget God, you start relying on your own strength. Compared to Abraham, we're hopeless, aren't we? I mean, he never once faltered in his faith. Did he? I think we're about to find out that actually Abram was remarkably like us. He messed up a lot. And although there's chapters that show great faith, there are moments where he completely bottles it and he's full of fear. Does that ring true of you? I know it certainly does of me. And if Abraham was as much like us as that, then, and was, you know, he became known as a man of faith, and there is hope for us all, I think. Even though there's thousands of years that separate us from Abraham, the life of Abraham, with all its successes and failures, can teach us a lot in our struggle to live by faith. I know if anyone needs to hear this message, I certainly do. But perhaps you feel the same. Perhaps there are many of us here who've come to realize that our walk of faith isn't quite what it could be, or maybe should be. So let's look at three principles, three really good principles from Abram's life that will help us to live lives of extraordinary faith, just like Abraham. Firstly, the life of faith means trusting God for the little things as well as big things. Okay, we're going to look at the passage. So if you have your Bibles open at Genesis chapter 12. And the passage that we're going to look at is from Genesis 12 verse 10. Actually, I think just for the sake of completeness, we'll maybe just read the whole of chapter 12. Chapter 12, it's page 8 in the Church Bibles. "The Lord had said to Abram, 'Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you.' So Abram left as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated, and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abram travelled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem. At that time the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he went on towards the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. Then Abram set out and continued towards the Negev. And this is the passage now that we're going to be looking at this evening. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while, because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife, Sarai, "I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you're my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you." When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. He treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants and maid servants and camels. But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarai. So Pharaoh summoned Abram. "What have you done to me?" he said. "Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, and with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with them. Abram had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold. From the Negev he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier, and where he had first built an altar. There Abram called on the name of the Lord. So we're going to look at three principles, like I said earlier, about life, living an extraordinary life of faith. First one, the life of faith means trusting God for little things as well as big things. This chapter, chapter 12, is a very famous passage. It's called the call of Abram. God calls Abram to go unconditionally to a place that was unknown to him, to step out in faith, leave his parents and family behind him, and all that was familiar and comfortable, and to obey God. Verse 4, we see Abram left, as the Lord told him. He trusts God's promises of blessing, and that God would make him into a great nation, God's chosen people. And so Abram just goes. He steps out in faith and he goes. What faith? You know, this is the Abram that we read about in Hebrews 11, isn't it? Fearlessly progressing into the land that God has led him to. And it's all going great, isn't it? Read verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. Ah, oh dear Abraham. Instead of trusting God when the famine came, Abram's gone into survival mode, hasn't he? But are Abram's actions that bad? I mean, let's think about it. To be fair, Abram has already been through several tests by this stage. He's been obedient to God's call and he's left his home and family behind him. That can't have been easy. His wife Sarai's barren. You know, back in those days that was considered to be a curse. To top it all, when he gets to the land God's promised him, we find out in verse 6 that it's already occupied. Someone else lives there. This has been a bumpy ride for Abram, so maybe, you know, that famine was just that one step too much, that sort of straw that broke the camel's back. Perhaps logic told Abram, look, just for a little while, let's just leave the country, you know, some of these physical needs need to be met, my family has needs, let's just, you know, pop out the country for a little while. You know, I have to take care of my family. Perhaps Abram's nearest and dearest were having a real go at him. Abram, what were you thinking by obeying God? What was going through your head, Abram? look where it's brought us. We're here in this desert, in the middle of nowhere, and we're going to die on our own. Well done, Abram. We don't know, do we, what kind of pressures Abram felt. But what we do see here is this kind of knee-jerk reaction to his circumstances. He starts taking things into his own hands. Before we start criticizing Abram, I think it's fair to say that we're probably quite similar, aren't we? Let's be honest. You know, this is a pit I think everyone falls into from time to time. You know, mini crisis sort of comes our way, and suddenly we start running through all the what ifs. You know, what if this happens to me? What if I don't get this? Or, you know, what if I contract that? Or, you know, all these what ifs start flowing through our minds, don't they? And so we start to plan a course of action to try and work our way through this difficult patch. And then something in our mind reminds us, what about God? We think, oh yes, God. Oh. Well, maybe we'll just ask God to bless our ways. You know, that's often the way that we think. But that's not how we should walk in faith, is it? Just like Abram, we might be happy to trust God with big things, but the smaller things can be harder. You know, Abraham was ready to leave everything and trust his whole family and everything into God's hands, stepping out into the unknown, but he wasn't willing to trust God for the immediate, just his family's need for food. You know, it's interesting that later on in chapter 15, God tells Abram not to be afraid. But if you look at that sort of word afraid, the Hebrew meaning for it, it can be described as this. I've got it written down. It's fear associated with common circumstances of everyday life. Fear associated with common circumstances of everyday life. Can you relate to that? I certainly can. You know, we may trust God with big things like our eternal salvation. Trust God with that. But then, you know, when it comes to our daily struggles, fear overtakes us, doesn't it? Decisions we have to make. Do we trust God for the eternal things, but panic over common everyday things? Our health, our needs, our family, our food, our jobs. Faith means trusting God for the little things as well as the big things. You know, thinking of Abram's choice, what should he have done instead? What would you have advised Abram to have done? During the terrible days of the Blitz, a father, holding his son by the hand, ran from a building that had just been struck by a bomb. In the front yard there was a big shell hole, and seeking shelter as quickly as possible, the father jumped into the hole and held up his arms for his son to follow. Terrified, yet hearing his father's voice yelling him to jump, the boy replied, "I can't see you. It's too black." The father, looking up against the sky that was tinted red by all the burning buildings, called to the silhouette of his son, "But I can see you. Jump." The boy jumped because he trusted his father. The Christian faith enables us to face life or to meet death, not because we can see, but with the certainty that we are seen. Not that we know all the answers, but that we are known. How can we trust God for the little things as well as the big things? Well, in some ways it's very simple. God wants us to exercise childlike faith. Abba, Daddy, help me, I'm scared. What would you have me do, Father? A childlike faith that knows that even though we can't see, we are seen by one we can totally trust. You know, the biblical approach to finding yourself in a dark and scary place is really the opposite to what our human nature would have us do, isn't it? Instead of, oh no, how am I going to get out of this situation? It should be, Lord, what can I get out of this situation? But that's not to say it's easy. It isn't. It's really not easy. But sometimes it takes more grace to stay in Canaan than it does to get there. Which is why it has been said, I love this quote, The will of God will never lead you where the grace of God cannot keep you. The will of God will never lead you where the grace of God cannot keep you. What should Abram have done? He should have sought the Lord's help, because Abraham, you are safer in a famine, in the will of God, than in a palace out of his will. God wants us to trust him with the big things, but also those small things that we love to hold on to. You know, if we don't let go and let God, then we get stressed, don't we? We get anxious. We get exhausted by it. We're full of fear. And I think this leads us to a second principle that we can learn from Abram's life that will help us live a life of faith. Not only does faith mean trusting God for the small things as well as the big things, the life of faith has no room for fear. There's no room for fear. We need to confront our fear with faith. Apparently, psychologists now list or have names for some 700 different kinds of phobias. No one, apparently, is immune. Everyone fears something. Everyone has a phobia of some sort. They range from arachibutyrophobia, which is the fear of getting peanut butter stuck to the roof of your mouth, to phobophobia, the fear of fear. You know, there's so many of these things, so many things we can be afraid of. But the Christian faith and fear are actually not compatible. They're not. It says in the Bible, "For God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." You know, fear is a fact of life. Even after we've been saved, we fear. But fear is the arch enemy of faith. And so we need to confront our fears with faith. But it's subtle, isn't it? I think fear can be so subtle. It doesn't give up easily. Chuck Swindoll said this. He said, "The fog called fear whispers omens of the unknown and the unseen. Surrounding individuals with its blinding, billowy robe, the creature hisses, 'What if? What if?'" I think we know what Chuck Swindoll means, don't we? Faith and fear are always at loggerheads with each other. And like the tide, you know, it goes in and out. We're very similar. You know, one minute we're acting as men and women of faith, and the next minute we're overcome with fear, in and out. In the words of Arthur Somers Roche, "Anxiety is a thin stream of fear trickling through the mind. If encouraged, it cuts a channel into which all other thoughts are drained." I think we know about that too, don't we? When fears occur, when we have these fears, they drain us. They consume our thought lives. And even, you know, when we do resist, we have that success. It's only a short time later that they're knocking on the door with the "what if, what if?" You know, these are whispers we hear every day, and they undermine the life of faith that God has called each one of us to. It's a continual struggle, but we must resist and we must keep trusting. We must confront our fears with faith. You know, in life there's many crossroads that we reach, aren't there? Places where we have to make a decision, which direction am I going to go? And there's times when we think, should I go this direction? It's a way that will require faith. It's a way that's unclear. Or should I go that way, which is a way that actually I'll probably be giving in to my fears? Sometimes it's actually not as clear-cut as that. Sometimes it's not until we've already chosen a path and we look back and we think, you know, it's been said that decisions that are based on faith head in the direction of peace and hope. You know, if we make a decision and our hearts are at peace and there's hope, then we've probably gone the way of faith. Whereas unbelief moves us in the direction of restlessness and of fear. Unbelief moves us in the direction of restlessness and fear. And often when fear becomes our motivation, we just end up getting deeper and deeper, spiraling out of control. I think that's what we see in these next verses here. Let's read verse 11 to 13. "As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, 'I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, "This is his wife." Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you.' For someone who has a quarter of Hebrews 11 dedicated to him and his life of faith, Abram continues to show a remarkable lack of faith, doesn't he, in that scene. Now that he's in this hostile territory, now he's in Egypt, he starts to scheme and to plan. Why? Well, verse 13 tells us, to save his own skin. It's as simple as that, to save his own skin. Oh, just as a side note, I mean, it's worth pointing out here that Sarai was 65 years old at this time. So it might seem a little bit strange to you that Abram thought she might be highly sought after by the Egyptians on account of her beauty. You know, I don't read women's magazines, you'll be pleased to hear, but I think I'm right in saying that you don't often see 65-year-olds on the cover of Vogue or Cosmopolitan. But not all cultures are quite as shallow and superficial as ours. You know, beauty is more than skin deep, isn't it? In other parts of the world, particularly in ancient times, beauty was more than just a good figure or looks. Actually, the word that's used here for beautiful is used elsewhere in the Bible to describe a cow as being a fine specimen. I need to tread very carefully, I think. But I think what might have been meant here is that Sarai was actually a fine specimen of womanhood. You know, maybe it was her demeanour, the way she carried herself, the way she dressed, her femininity. There was obviously a lot about her that would have been very attractive to the opposite sex, despite her age. And given that marriage was highly respected in that culture at that time, if someone wanted Sarai, they would have had to got rid of the husband first. So that's why Abraham's thinking, look, if you say you're my sister, then they won't kill me. You know, maybe I could be your kind of guardian brother, so that if someone wants you and asks for your hand in marriage, then maybe I could stall them for long enough, you know, a long engagement, and so that once this famine's over, we can just leg it out of here and be safe. It's a cunning plan, Abram. Very clever. Brilliant scheming. And actually, to be fair, it's not a complete lie. It's a little white lie, because Sarai was apparently his half-sister, according to Genesis 20. You know, it's clever, but actually it's wrong. It's wrong and it's evil on several levels. Why? Because firstly, Abram took God out of the equation, didn't he? You know, Abram forgot that actually there's options that are available to God that we can't see. You know, God alone has the power to intervene. And on a second level, it put his wife at huge risk. You know, all because Abram wanted to save his skin. You know, if someone took her as his wife, if someone took Sarai, it would be jeopardizing what God had told him about his offspring being made into a great nation. You know, Abram is not living by faith here. This is fear. Abram's living by fear. And what happens? Well, we read in verse 14 and 15, Abram's fears became reality. When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. Forget the long engagement plan, Abram. Pharaoh hasn't bothered with it. He's just taken Sarai straight into his household. You know, Abram's plans and all his scheming are in ruins. To make matters worse, if you look at verse 16... Pharaoh treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants and maidservants, and camels. You know, all these gifts back then were serious provisions of wealth. It's like a Saudi prince, you know, giving you a Rolex watch, and maybe a posh penthouse apartment, and a platinum credit card, and a new Ferrari. You know, these are serious gifts that he's been given. So you'd think that would make Abram pretty happy, really. But no, these things later on will cause Abram problems. You see, not only will this wealth be a constant reminder to him that Sarai's no longer in his household, she's in Pharaoh's, but later on we see in chapter 13 that this wealth causes a problem with Lot, which means they have to go their separate ways. Then there's Hagar, the Egyptian maidservant he's given as a gift. See, in chapter 16 she brings terrible division and sorrow in that home. You know, that's another stage of Abram's life that is marked with fear, isn't it? You know, Abram, against God's will, decides to start a family with her. And so she becomes the mother of the Arab nations. And Sarai, the mother of the Jewish nations. And we know today, don't we, those Jews and Arabs are constantly at loggerheads. So even today, we're feeling the consequences of Abram's bad choices, of Abram's motivation by fear rather than faith. It's so important that we confront our fear with faith. I think it's strange that sometimes we assume that people who are wealthy are somehow blessed by God and in his will, whereas those who are not so wealthy, you know, whose lives are full of hardship, well, somehow they must be out of God's will and not blessed by God. But that's not always the case, as we see here. You know, it's better to experience famine in the will of God than great riches and wealth out of his will. And then we see these wonderful words appear in the next verse. But the Lord. God intervenes. Despite some major mess-ups, despite being faithless, despite Abram being motivated by fear, God acts. He acts. 2 Timothy 2:13, if we are faithless, he will remain faithful. Praise the Lord. Let's read the rest of the chapter. Verse 17 to 20. But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarai. So Pharaoh summoned Abram. What have you done to me? He said. Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister? So that I took her to be my wife. Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had. In order to protect Sarai and to preserve God's promise, God sends this disease on Pharaoh's household. We don't know what this disease was. Some commentators have suggested it was quite possibly a sexual disease that prevented Pharaoh from getting intimate with Sarai. We don't know. All we know is that Pharaoh has this disease and he traces it back to the time when Sarai arrives in his household. And as a consequence, he wants them away. Off. You know, looking at these verses, isn't it interesting that it's Pharaoh here who takes the higher moral ground? You know, he says, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why didn't you tell me? You know, the godless Pharaoh is actually the one who acts more honorably than the God-fearing Abram. You know, this is a huge embarrassment and a disgrace for someone that we think of as being a man of faith, isn't it? Abram is exposed here as being a dishonest, scheming man. You know, if Abram had stayed in Canaan when the famine came, he would have grown in his faith. Instead of faith and instead of fearing God, he feared the consequences of completely letting go. And this then spiraled into these sins that we've seen of unbelief, selfishness, deceit, and a lot of humiliation. But God, in his mercy, bailed him out, and Abram was restored. And these final verses that we see here in chapter 13, verses 1 to 4, they remind us of that. They remind us that there is life after failure. When we fall, we can return to God, and we can learn from our own mistakes. Let's read verses 1 to 4. So Abram went from Egypt to the Negev with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. Abram had been very wealthy in livestock and silver and gold. From the Negev he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier, and where he had first built an altar. There Abram called on the name of the Lord. Not only is the life of faith about trusting God for the small things, as well as the big things, it's also about giving no room to fear, to confront fear with faith. And thirdly, the third principle I think we can learn from Abram's life is that the life of faith is full of new beginnings. It's full of new beginnings. Apparently when Coca-Cola was introduced in China for the first time, their attempts at finding a phonetic equivalent in the Chinese language resulted in a drink called Bite the Wax Tadpole. Now, you'd have thought that Pepsi Cola, you know, their biggest rival, would have probably learned from Coca-Cola's mistake. But they didn't do too well with their Chinese advertising either. You know, their Pepsi Cola's, what's it called now? Come Alive with the Pepsi Generation, that slogan. When it was translated into Chinese, it turned into Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the grave. And, you know, just like Pepsi should have learned from Coca-Cola's boo-boo, you would think that Abram would have learned from this monumental loss of faith that we've just read about. But astonishingly, in chapter 20, he falls into the exact same pit of fear. He tries to pull off the exact same stunt, but this time not with Pharaoh, but with King Abimelech. You know, like Abram, we fall over and over again, don't we? And yet God never gives up on us. The life of faith is a life of new beginnings. You know, we fall, we get up again, we turn repentantly to the Lord, and we move on. New beginnings. You know, just like we learned this morning when we were looking at Jonah, our God is not a one-chance God. The life of faith is full of new beginnings. So if God can make someone who's as deceitful as Abram into someone he called my friend, then I think he could do the same for you and for me. Any man or woman, regardless of how spiritual we are, is capable of failing in the faith. But when our faith does fail, God doesn't. He doesn't. The question I have for you this evening is, are you someone who longs to live a life that is less fear, more faith? Less fear, more faith? There's a lot we can learn from Abram. Just like we learn from our own mistakes, we make a mistake and we learn from it. You know, let's learn from Abram's failures. Let's learn from his mistakes. May it be that we would approach hardship by, instead of taking it into our own hands, trying to work it out ourselves, that we would say, look, here is another opportunity to trust God. And remember, you know, as we do that, that we would remember these words from Isaiah 28. The one who trusts will never be dismayed. The one who trusts will never be dismayed. Let's encourage each other to live lives of faith and not fear. Let's trust God for the small things as well as the big things. Let's be childlike in our faith. And let's never give up when we fall. And may it be that we too will be known as friends of God and men and women of faith.